This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's fine to be a higher seed, of whom much is expected, but in the NCAAs, the lower seeds, neglected, can sometimes wake themselves and stir, and sometimes they prevail. And every time that happens, some much higher seed must fail. Just ask number 3 seed Iowa. They fell to number 14 seed Northwestern State yesterday. Among the other favored teams to lose in the first round of the men's NCAA basketball tournament were Nevada, a number 5 seed that fell to Montana on Thursday, and Syracuse, beaten by Texas A&M. Last night, number 16 seed Albany ran with number 1 seed Connecticut for much of their game, leading by 12 with less than 12 minutes left. But in that dogfight, the Huskies caught and passed the Great Danes, eventually winning by 13. In some of the more intriguing second-round games today, Duke will play George Washington in Greensboro, Indiana and Gonzaga square off in Salt Lake City, and Villanova takes on Arizona in Philadelphia. As the tournament dwindles down to the Sweet 16, the Elite 8, the Final Four, and the Terrific 2, many will forget the chaotic excitement of Round 1's first day of play, which may as well be called Thunderous Thursday, and don't bother copywriting that because I've already beaten you to it. Anyway, a recent study by job placement firm Challenger, Gray, and Christmas estimates that each March, as many as $3.8 billion, yes, that's billion with a B, are lost to U.S. businesses whose employees are mired in the madness. Only a Game's hardworking Gabe O'Connor ventured out on the day, which I'm sure will henceforth be universally referred to as Thunderous Thursday, to witness the wasted hours of the unproductive, and he has this report.
Brian Lackey is a Boston College graduate student and employee. On Thursday, he joined his friends at a local bar to watch his BC Eagles in a noonish first-round game. He thought it better that way.
I think that I've done my company a favor by not showing up today because I know I'm not going to do anything. And they should thank me for not showing up.
Lackey admitted that he actually had the day off, but was quick to point out Friday wasn't going to be any more productive.
Well, it's that second day hangover. You have to take off the first day, and the second day you pretend like you're not as involved. But you actually do about 2-3 hours of work just before the tournament, and the rest of the day is spent online watching this stuff.
Watching the game with Lackey was John Zeller, a graduate assistant at BC. He sees no way around losing man hours to the tournament.
I don't know, I feel like for the next couple of weekends, if you want a social life, or you know, if you want to be involved in the water cooler talk, you gotta be up on your college basketball at least for 3 weeks, because bottom line, it's what everybody's talking about.
They weren't talking about the tourney at the Harvard Art Museums, which suits PR officer Darren Manoogian just fine, since the BC alum taped the Eagles' first round game against Pacific. He avoided sports websites all day so he could watch the action after work without knowing the outcome. Darren deleted emails and cut off calls from friends that wanted to talk about the Eagles' double overtime victory. On Thursday, he may have been the most productive sports fan in America, but it wasn't always that way.
In past years, I was not so productive. In fact, last year, I left my job and went to a bar next door to eat lunch and watched BC play for 2 hours and then went back to the office. But I can't get away with that this year because I have sort of a real job.
Maybe now is the time to point out Darren's old job was promoting Only a Game. Ironically, just as the Eagles dispatched the Tigers, someone from the good old days called.
Hi, Bill. I'm good. How are you? Oh, I gotta go. Bye. That was Bill Littlefield. He was trying to tell me the score of a game. It's sort of nice to hear from him, but, you know, he was going to tell me. I had to hang up.
Perhaps not every office is united by the bracket, but in one instance it brought a father and son closer. Jerry Martin of Boston explained as he hoisted a couple at a Boston-area sports bar.
My 11-year-old son, I had to dismiss him at 12:30 today so he could watch the BC game. Okay, the whole game. So I had to make a note up that he had a doctor's appointment at 12:30. There you go. That's how bad it was at my house.
And they bought it?
I don't know. He gave the note. I made him pass the note to his teacher, so tomorrow he'll probably give himself up. You know?
How did you keep track of scores at work? Or do you work?
Call him. Okay. Yeah, that's how I keep score. So I call him, he lets lets me know what's going on. He's got it all plastered above his bed. He's got it taped on his on the wall above his bed, and he just eliminates it as it goes. So,
are you going to give him another written excuse tomorrow?
Yeah, I'm going to give me one. Okay, so that'll work.
Sometimes lost productivity is the most dangerous pitfall encountered on the tournament's first day. Willie Crocker of Louisville, whose Cardinals aren't even in the tourney, explains.
I was here at 12, I think if you check the tab, it's 12:13.
How you holding up?
It's not a bad night for drinking. It could be worse.
Not a bad day for drinking.
Great day for drinking, but not a bad night.
Are you going to do the same thing tomorrow?
No. I'll work tomorrow. But I have a drunk hangover tomorrow, so...
You don't say.
It's always a drunk hangover.
Is there a sober hangover?
Yeah, of course there is.
When's that going to happen?
That's next Friday. So, I mean, don't worry about that. I mean, today's today and tomorrow's tomorrow.
And maybe that's the lesson any employer should take from all this. Tomorrow is tomorrow, and the basketball fan skipping work to watch the big dance might be doing you a favor. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Boston.
The women's NCAA tournament begins today, and it is not without controversy. Astonishing. Joining me now to discuss traditional winners, potential upstarts, and those who are happy just to be there is Michelle Smith, who writes about women's college basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle. She joins me on the line from Denver. Michelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
One of the two high seeds in Denver, where you will be watching games, is Stanford. And I guess the question there is, how far can Candace Wiggins, who is perhaps not often enough regarded as one of the best players in the country, take that team?
You know, I think that the pressure is off of them this year. Last year, they finished as the number one ranked team. They had five seniors who really wanted to take it a long way. Not that they don't want to take it a long way, but there's a couple of freshmen in the starting lineup, and certainly Candace is the engine that drives them, but I think that the expectations are a little lower, so playing without pressure will be interesting because they may be able to take it, you know, back to the Elite Eight again.
Another team beginning tournament play in Denver is Louisiana Tech, one of the three teams from Louisiana to make the tournament. La Tech went 26-5. They have participated in every big dance since 81-82 when the women's NCAA tournament began. How difficult will it be for them to advance?
Well, they're an 11 seed, and that's mostly a reflection of the conference that they play in, which is not very highly regarded. And, you know, all of those years under Leon Barmore, they were contenders every year, and they've been less so over the last few years with a couple of coaching changes. I think that they would be a spoiler if they could move on even to the Sweet 16. I don't think a lot of people think that, you know, as an 11 seed, they're going to do much damage.
The most publicized pre-tournament story had Tennessee coach Pat Summitt claiming that her team had been slighted by the selection committee. They've established the Vols as a number two seed. Were you surprised that Coach Summitt employed the ever-popular nobody respects us gambit?
You know, not really. I mean, I think Pat just couldn't figure out what happened. She schedules tougher than anybody in the country every year, mm-hmm. and they did have a couple of stumbles. They lost at home to Florida, and they lost at Kentucky. And I think it was the first time they had lost the two unranked teams ever in the same season. And, you know, so they did stumble a bit. They lost their point guard. One of them transferred out. One of them got injured, so they were using their shooting guard as a point guard. I mean, it has not been an easy season, but they've weathered it pretty well. They won the SEC tournament, and I think Pat has a gripe. I don't, you know, it's interesting. I was chatting with one of the committee members after the fact who said, you know, I guess we always make somebody mad. I said, yes, but you've made the most high-profile coach in the country mad, which means everybody's going to hear about it.
Well, whether you credit Pat Summitt's assessment of the work of the selection committee or not, is it fair to say, as many have said, that the Cleveland region is the toughest in the tournament?
It looks that way. I mean, North Carolina is presumed to be the overall number one seed, which is actually interesting on this S-curve that they use, which leads us to the conclusion that Tennessee was the lowest of the number two seeds. So not only did the Lady Vols not get a number one, but apparently they're regarded as the lowest of the number twos, which makes no sense. But then in that bracket, there's also Rutgers, a very good team. There are a couple of very good teams in UCLA and Purdue. You know, North Carolina will have to play Vanderbilt at home on the Commodores' home floor in the second round. It really is just a very difficult bracket.
Well, then maybe the coach at UNC, Sylvia Hatchell, has as much reason to complain about her brackets as Pat Summitt has to complain about hers. But Hatchell has said she's fine with a draw. She feels the tough early opponents are going to prepare her team for the later rounds. So does that logic work?
I think that was her second reaction, though. Her first reaction was, geez, it looks like the Final Four. Now, the first thing's out of her mouth, I think she was a bit surprised. I'm not sure she was angry. I think that, you know, Tennessee gets to the Final Four seemingly every year. Pat has a team that's good enough to get there every year. North Carolina is a program that's on its way back up. I don't think maybe Sylvia Hatchell figured she could afford to complain a lot, considering that she's the favorite by a lot of people to win that national championship.
The Ivy League sends its champion into this tournament each March, and this year it's Dartmouth, and they not only have to play a very good Rutgers team, they have to play in Rutgers' backyard, Trenton, New Jersey.
Trenton, yes.
Any chance Dartmouth finds its way to round two?
No.
Short answer.
Well, I would not be surprised if Rutgers ended up beating Tennessee to get to the regional final against North Carolina, if you presume that the brackets and the seeds are going to hold. Rutgers is very, very good, and just I don't see an upset of that magnitude. The best teams in the country this year are all very good, but there are quite a few of them. I mean, I think that people think there are legitimately 8 to 10 teams who nobody would be surprised if they showed up in the Final Four. And that's, you know, some pretty good depth for the women's game, and Rutgers is on that list.
Okay, so 8 or 10 teams have a legitimate shot to win this tournament, but the time has come for you to pick a winner, hard as it has been for all the experts to pick against UNC. Can you find another champion?
I picked UNC, but I have Connecticut in the final against them, just because I think that they've got a nice road through Bridgeport. I think they're a good team. They've been playing well lately. So I wouldn't be surprised to see Connecticut in the Final Four and even in the final game, but I'm still going to go with the Tar Heels. I'm going to be like everybody else.
Well, if it works out that way and Connecticut wins, that would just thrill Pat Summitt.
Oh, would make it all the better. Or all the more bitter, one of the two.
Michelle Smith writes about women's college basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle. She joined me from Denver, where 8 teams will begin tournament play today and tonight. Michelle, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a peek into the soul of Korean baseball. But first, elite athletes with physical disabilities have spent the past week thrilling crowds in Torino and surrounding mountain towns. More than 550 athletes are currently participating in the 2006 Paralympic Winter Games. Each skier, curler, hockey player, and biathlete has a story to tell about a car crash, work accident, or birth defect. But the stories this week have more to do with carving powder in the Alps, taking out an opponent's curling stone, or putting the puck in the net. From Torino, Nancy Greenlee's report.
A skier zips down the Super G course in Sestriere, carving a line in the glistening snow. It looks like a repeat of last month's Olympic Games, but a closer glance reveals some differences. U.S. Alpine skier Sandy Ducat balances on one full leg. She's just finished in a satisfying sixth place in the standing Super G. The 33-year-old says the Paralympics will capture the world's attention as soon as people realize that Paralympians are every bit as talented as their more celebrated Olympic counterparts.
I mean, we're coming down the same hill as the Bodie Millers and the Darren Rolfs and whomever else. And, you know, and I'm doing it on one ski, and I'm taking those G-force turns and whatnot. So it's going to catch on, and it's going to be really exciting when it does.
Ducat is leading the way as one of few professional athletes with a disability. Her rosy complexion from many hours spent on the mountains in Vail, Colorado, matches her outlook on life. Born without a femur in her right leg, she had her foot amputated at 4 and was fitted with a prosthesis. From then on, she was up and running and swimming and playing baseball before falling in love with skiing. The 2-time Paralympian also discovered that although skiing among the disabled is technically an individual sport, in some ways it's not.
Because we have to work together to make this happen. So it's not everybody out here for themselves. It's just like, all right, there's my teammate. I'm going to grab a ski, or I'm going to grab his bag, or he's going to grab what I need, you know. And we're looking out for each other differently than I think maybe an able-bodied team.
Some Olympic observers complained about a U.S. team that had a hot-dogging snowboarder and millionaire skiers sequestered in their own RVs. The Paralympians tend to show more fortitude and less attitude. This spirit and lower ticket prices have attracted swarms of mostly Italian fans. Today's gold medal games in sledge hockey and wheelchair curling are sold out. Curling is the newest Paralympic sport and had close to a full house for even some preliminary rounds of competition. Twenty-somethings in bubble sunglasses sit next to senior citizens in fishing caps at the Pinerolo Palagaccio venue. They cheer every time an Italian Paralympian even touches a curling stone. Italian Andrea Tabanelli, gap-toothed and often grinning, gets plenty of love.
I am the first player in Italy in a wheelchair.
The 45-year-old Tabanelli is the team skip. A motorbike accident left him a paraplegic 20 years ago. As often happens in Italy, a meal changed his life. He dined 6 years ago with a group of able-bodied curlers who had a suggestion.
One night they said to me, we go to eat a pizza, but before we play, you want to play with us? I can try. I try and, this is good.
Wheelchair curlers are able to play alongside the able-bodied, which is a real draw for Tabanelli and other competitors. While Paralympic wheelchair curling is restricted to those with limited lower body movement, the sport itself could be played by almost anybody. All you need is mobility in at least one arm. U.S. curler Augusto Perez has the touch. The 33-year-old tried curling for the first time on October 16th of last year. 7 weeks later, he was on the U.S. Paralympic team. A natural athlete, he left his native Spain to play on a soccer scholarship in the States before losing his leg to cancer about 3 years ago. He says curling provides a competitive outlet almost as satisfying as soccer.
Well, the only thing that I miss is the physical contact. Full body curling didn't fly with the federation, but it's just the level and the intensity. I love right before the game starts, you get butterflies in your stomach.
Apparently, Perez and his U.S. teammates couldn't quite overcome their nervousness as the U.S. lost 6-4 to Sweden and 10-3 to Norway on Sunday. The U.S. failed to make the medal round. Inside the Torino Esposizioni, sledge hockey players smash into each other as they jockey for position. They use two shortened hockey sticks with blades on one end and on the other a metal pick used to propel themselves forward and to poke each other when the refs aren't watching.
You'll find all of us maybe a little passive-aggressive.
That's Lonnie Hanna, a U.S. sledge hockey team member who won gold in Salt Lake City 4 years ago. Like many Paralympians, he says he's in better shape now than when he lost use of his legs at 20 in a warehouse accident. Last year, he was diagnosed with melanoma. When asked about his ordeals, Hanna becomes philosophical.
It's been a great life. If I could change it, I wouldn't.
Really? Really?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been a wonderful life. And we just count our blessings and we don't look back. And I think that's a uniqueness of all of the disabled athletes. We don't look back. We just look forward.
Hanna's U.S. sledge hockey team will play in today's bronze medal game. The 2006 Paralympic Winter Games will conclude tomorrow with cross-country and alpine skiing and closing ceremonies. For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlace in Torino.
To send comments about what you've heard on Only a Game, rifle through our voluminous audio archives, or see what our cameras capture when we're in the field, please visit onlyagame.org. Goliath has fallen to Mexico, not to mention to Korea and to Canada before that. But let's talk about a team that's still playing in the inaugural World Baseball Classic. Korea was not initially regarded as a likely semifinalist, but not only is the team undefeated, Korea is the only side that hasn't committed an error. The success of the Korean team, which will meet Japan in the semifinal today, has surprised even some residents of Korea. Joining me now from Seoul is Jenna Park of the LA Times. Jenna, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you.
There are several Korean major leaguers, of course, but before this tournament began, the only thing many Americans knew about the Korean baseball organization was that the league had banned a player from wearing cabbage leaves under his hat to keep his head cool. How popular is baseball in Korea?
Baseball is very popular in Korea. It's probably the most popular sports among men and students. It's just not as commercialized as in the States and Japan. And the professional league is rather small because it's, in a good sense, of about pure sports. And what surprised everyone at the World Baseball Classic are these unknown pitchers and players. But reporters and people and experts in this field forget that the Korean team did win the bronze medal at the Sydney Olympics.
I'm sure you talked with a lot of baseball fans this week. Did you find that there were a lot of people who previously perhaps hadn't cared much about baseball, but suddenly they're passionately interested now?
Oh, yes, many are. This has become a very national passion, and suddenly even housewives are expert umpires of ruling the game and telling whether it was a safe or out, and practically all Koreans have now become experts in this sport.
In this tournament, Korea has beaten the United States, of course, which brought the game to Korea just over 100 years ago, but the team also beat Japan not only once but twice. Which victory has been more significant to the Korean people?
I think it was the U.S. team, actually, because they had no idea how even our Korean players could compete with the phenomenal and historically famous and worldly great champions of the Major League Baseball. Some fans are writing, posting messages online that they would have preferred to meet the Americans Sunday, not the Japanese again.
The third time they'll play Japan in the semifinal. And I understand that the city of Seoul will give fans plenty of opportunities to watch that game and cheer for the team.
Yes, they're already opening up baseball stadiums and soccer stadiums and also the Seoul City Plaza. And it might extend to the major part of downtown Seoul because of many fans.
Will you be among them?
I certainly do intend to be, yes.
Jenna Park is with the Los Angeles Times in Seoul. Jenna, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you. It was a great pleasure to talk to you, too.
Not all those cheering for Korea in the semifinals will be in South Korea. Southern California boasts hundreds of thousands of Korean Americans, the largest contingent of Koreans outside Korea, which has made the team's games in Anaheim this week very lively, to say the least. Clinton Lee, who's been described as a major Major League Baseball fan, is a Korean American on the line from Orange County, California. Clinton, welcome to Only a Game.
How are you doing?
Very well. Thank you. I understand that you were at Wednesday's game between Korea and Japan. Tell me a little bit about how fans were showing their team spirit there.
Well, it was a pretty crazy environment. I'd say like at least 80% of the fans there were Korean Americans or, you know, people from Korea. And the funny thing is a lot of the cheers, you know, that you were hearing were actually more soccer based, like they kind of came from the soccer matches. But I mean, they're generic cheers. Like one is you're chanting Republic of Korea,
uh-huh.
And the other one that I heard was like a kind of like a fight song that's basically saying like victory for Korea.
So no hooray for the goalie type cheers.
Nothing like that. But that's where most of the cheers kind of like you. That's where I would hear them. Mm-hmm. I never really heard them anywhere else.
I'm told that you're a Mets fan, so
that's
I
correct.
Assume that you have followed Mets left-handed reliever Dae-Sung Koo, but were you familiar with many of the other names on the Korean roster?
Well, I pretty much know all of the major leaguers. There's only like a handful of Korean baseball players in the majors anyway, so it's not hard to kind of know those guys. Mm-hmm. But other than the people who actually played in the majors, the only other one I knew was Sung-Yup Lee, the guy who has like five home runs and six games or something like that. And that's the only other one I know other than the major league players.
Well, now that you've seen the Korean national team in action and they have done so well, do you think you'll be paying any closer attention to baseball being played in Korea? Or are you still major league fan watching major leaguers coming from Korea?
Probably not. I wouldn't even know how to begin watching a major Korean league game. My Korean's probably not good enough to understand what was going on anyway. I mean, it'd be like watching a game with no sound for me.
Or too much sound.
Right, exactly. So I really doubt I'll ever watch a Korean league game, even their World Series or whatever it is.
All right, I'm going to put you on the spot with this last question. In your completely unbiased opinion, can Korea go all the way, beat Japan, get into the finals, and win the whole thing?
I don't see why they can't. Like, honestly, coming into this whole thing, you know, in my opinion, the Korean players aren't as good as the Japanese players. They're not as good as the United States players. But for whatever reason, maybe they have clutch hitting, or Koreans in general have a lot of national pride. Maybe something about that just kind of triggers something where they're just a little bit better that day, you know? Because in my opinion, there's no reason they should be 6-0. They shouldn't have beat the United States. They shouldn't have beat Japan twice. I mean, I kind of was just thinking, you know, hopefully we'll win, you know, a game against Japan. Hopefully we'll make it to the second round. If you would have asked me beforehand, I would have said there's no way they make it to the semifinals. But now that we're in the semifinals, I don't see any reason why we can't win it.
Clinton Lee is a Mets fan living in Orange County, California. Clinton, thank you very much for speaking with me.
No problem.
You're listening to Only a Game. As San Diego prepares for the semifinal games of the inaugural World Baseball Classic, what's the most remarkable story the tournament has produced so far? Korea's exemplary fielding, the solid pitching of the Dominican Republic's team, which was expected to prevail, if at all, by outslugging their opponents. The ability of the Cubans to play just well enough to advance to the semis in a tournament from which the U.S. government initially tried to ban them. The goofy possibility that the final stat in the long and illustrious career of Roger Clemens might be an L against Mexico. All these stories will fade, but what will remain, at least for me, are the images of celebration. The game between the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico had the fans waving banners and hugging each other inning after inning. After Mexico eliminated the U.S. on Thursday night, the Mexican players danced and cheered as if they'd won the World Series, never mind that earlier they, too, had been knocked out of the tournament. Baseball has rarely been in greater need of joy. Each home run Barry Bonds whacks in spring training reminds fans that once the season begins, every baseball fan who doesn't live in San Francisco is going to have to choose between several alternatives. Do they cheer Bonds as he chases Babe Ruth and Henry Aaron? Do they disparage him as a cheat and a liar and then buy tickets so they can scream insults at him? Or do they dismiss Major League Baseball altogether as a drug-riddled freak show presided over by an inept non-entity? Always in the spring, baseball has provided a sense of summer fun about to begin again. Often, baseball has been beset with controversy, whether it's had to deal with a strike threat, a lockout threat, gambling charges, or the bad publicity generated by owners looking for free ballparks, or by players maintaining that multi-million-dollar contract offers are insulting. But when have the contrasting currents been as powerful as they are this spring? Some U.S. baseball fans may turn away from the World Baseball Classic now that the U.S. team is no longer involved, but if the 06 season, highlighted by the record-chasing and controversial Bonds, turns out to be the grim, ugly, contentious debacle it probably can't avoid being, those same fans may find themselves yearning for the happy days of unfettered, unadulterated baseball celebration that the winning teams have been enjoying during March. Thank you. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com, and Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we visit the mind of Bill James, and then we climb back into the light. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
I wondered what all those numerals hanging off your elbows were. Statistical stalactites.
As the man who wants to run the Major League Baseball team that will inevitably play in Havana, how do you like Cuba's presence in today's semifinals of the World Baseball Classic?
Oh, those of us who are already raising money for Louis Tiant Memorial Stadium to be built on the shore of the Bay of Pigs are very excited that Cuba will be advancing, even though the United States of America has taken a sad early departure.
Yes, indeed. This week, the U.S. put machine guns on its Great Lakes Coast Guard vessels. Charlie, that's not because the Canadian team beat the U.S. at the World Baseball Classic,
no,
is it?
I don't think so. However, I'm not entirely sure the War of 1812 has ever come to a satisfactory conclusion, and you can't never tell what them Canucks are up to.
Meanwhile, Barry Bonds, who was rebuffed in his attempt to play for his country in the Classic, will apparently be investigated unless he won't be investigated. Bud Selig hasn't decided yet. Should Bonds be worried?
I'm quoting now from Commissioner Bud's statement. Whatever decision I make will be on what I believe is what we should do and what is clearly necessary and is in the best interest of the sport. To borrow a line from Mel Brooks, I'd like to thank Commissioner Bud Selig for that piece of authentic, bureaucratic frontier gibberish. Basically, what he means is, I want this off my desk, and with any luck, the IRS is going to throw his well-punctured keister into the slam for me anyway, and I won't have to deal with it.
Condolences to you,
yeah,
dear friend and Marquette alum, because
yeah,
the war, the golden, whatever they're called,
yeah,
now, were eliminated from the tourney on Thursday.
Yeah.
At least they got to play, though.
Yeah. In the annals of Warrior hoop lore, the name Jean Felix of Alabama will go up there with Rick Roby and Rick Mount and a number of other miscreants from early times. They couldn't guard the three well enough. They had one thing that did concern me. They were a freshman-heavy team, and they were all set to play, and then that incredible event happened where they had to vacate the stadium and then bring everybody back. And I have a feeling that probably cost them in the first half, that and the fact that they couldn't guard a three.
Which of today's men's second round and women's first round games will you be watching?
Well, I think the most interesting one in the women's bracket, of course, is the University of Tennessee, which is a number two seed and playing the Cadets of Army in Cleveland. I would almost guarantee they haven't played each other four times in the history of their programs. As for the men, the most interesting game is Duke and George Washington. George Washington barely survived. Duke had an easy time with the Jaguars of Southern. It was a bad day for Jaguars, by the way. Both Jaguars got beat. Alabama and the Southern Jaguars both got beat.
But a good day
for
Pops.
And the continuing interesting story of Indiana, which is playing for a coach who isn't going to be there as soon as they lose. They will play Gonzaga, which had the expected rough time against Xavier in the first round, and I'm not sure Indiana won't beat him.
One of the most recognizable men on the college basketball sideline announced his retirement this week. Charlie, will you miss John Chaney?
I'll miss the fact that he bounced around. He looked more like Muddy Waters than anybody I ever saw. And he had, you know, he got a couple of fractious moments in press conferences, most of which have been completely overblown. But the best thing I remember about John Chaney is he used to make his players practice at 5 in the morning, and someone asked the late Al McGuire one time what he thought of that, and he said, well, if I was ever competing with John Chaney for a player, I would call that player every morning at 4:30 and say, this is the time you'll be getting up when you go to Temple every day.
If you look at the NBA standings, it's tempting to say that things can't get worse for the New York Knicks.
Oh, yes, they can.
But if you read about the squabbling between Knick coach Larry Brown and point guard Stephon Marbury, well, you tell me, can things get worse?
Yes, they can, because Stephon Marbury has been a stubborn pain in the neck his entire life, and so is Larry Brown, and Larry Brown is older than Stephon Marbury, so he has more practice at it. However, Stephon Marbury did give us an intriguing explanation. Larry Brown took him out of a film session to chew him out, and Marbury said, he flexed a real hard juice card. I know that. Some young folks out there can please send in a translation because I'm not exactly sure what that means, but it doesn't sound good at all.
The National Hockey League will experience a dramatic fashion revolution this weekend. Charlie, some players will be using pink hockey sticks in order to raise awareness of breast cancer and simultaneously salute hockey moms everywhere. What do you think? Will the pink sticks catch on?
If they were really doing tribute to hockey moms. They'd play these games in tiny arenas at 5 o'clock in the morning with
it.
Nothing at the concession stands but bad coffee machines and Heath bars out of the candy.
I remember
I really think this is a terrific thing for the NHL to do. Where did they find pink wood?
Sports fans in Las Vegas will soon be preparing for a tournament that will provide its winner with a $50,000 prize. I wonder if this event will rock the place or if the organizers will have to cut expenses and paper the house.
Yes, the World Rock, Paper, Scissors Championships will be heading to Vegas. You absolutely know this will be on the boards at the sportsbook, and people will bet on it. I wonder if you can bet not only on individual players, but on whether rock, paper, or scissors will be the decisive move that wins.
In the ever-popular My Lunch is Bigger Than Yours category, we received this week news of a 5-pound mango and a 15-pound hamburger, both apparently world records.
This
which is
not
why
it is sports.
It's a world record.
The 5-pound mango is not a sport. The 15-pound hamburger from Denny's Beer Barrel Pub in Clearfield, Pennsylvania, you know, that's an amazing piece of meat. However, let me read you the AP lead on the 5-pound monster mango. When Colleen Porter took her mango to the local grocer, it wasn't to sell it, but to weigh it and show it off. I would like to point out that not only is that the biggest mango in the history of mangoes, that sentence contains more double entendres than any single sentence ever written in the English language.
And that's a world record, and that's why it's a sport. The NCAA crowned its 2006 rifle champions last weekend, Charlie, and Army came in third. But at least they beat Kentucky, which I suppose is heartening.
Kentucky people would have won, except it took them longer to load the flintlocks than their regular.
Right.
They have to use the ramrod. I think the winners, though, which you didn't mention, keeping our northern border safe in case communism ever comes back across the Bering Straits, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, the 2006 NCAA national champions, with an aggregate score of 4,682. And please give me the nickname of the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
I don't know.
The Nanooks!
I was going to say the sharpshooters is what it should be, but
not the monster mangoes.
And finally, Charlie, World of Warcraft is a massive multiplayer online game which more than 5 million people play, 1.5 million of them in China, apparently. But recently, Chinese gamers got an alternative. Will you rush right out and buy Learn from Li Feng?
The new online game starring the Chinese Communist Party's legendary hero. He apparently spent all his time and money serving the needy and helping the Liberation Party until he died, tragically dying in an accident in 1962. But I'm sort of depressed by the prize here, because when you go through the online game, it's just basically a treasure hunt. You don't win like a special weapon or a pile of gold or the right to eat more Cheetos than everybody else in your Dungeons & Dragons club. You win a copy of Mao's collected works. You win a tiny little cyber book. I don't know about anything else, but I refuse to believe that Chinese children are that boring.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. If you are a baseball fan, you probably regard Bill James as either a genius or an insufferable pedant. For over 30 years, James has been maintaining that many of the traditional ways of rating ballplayers, by their batting averages, for example, or how many bases they steal, are short-sighted and counterproductive. Especially as a younger critic of the ways of baseball men, James did not suffer critics, whom he regarded as fools, gladly. Nor was he shy about calling players he felt were overrated frauds, and managers who overrated those players idiots. Scott Gray, who has written a book titled The Mind of Bill James, How a Complete Outsider Changed Baseball, offers a more balanced view of Bill James. He joins me now from WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. Scott Gray, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
Bill James is the author of numerous editions of the Baseball Abstract. He's a student of the game's history, the inventor of many of the measures of talent embraced by the Society of American Baseball Research. He's an advisor now to the Boston Red Sox as well. One theme in your book is that many people mischaracterize Bill James as simply a numbers cruncher. Was it to correct that impression that you wrote The Mind of Bill James?
I think that's pretty accurate. On the cover of the book is this bobblehead doll, and Bill's friend Mike Cope said something kind of funny to me, which was that he hoped Bill wouldn't sue me for defamation of caricature. But to me, the bobblehead doll kind of represents something, which is that the media tends to take a complex subject and simplify it and make a caricature out of it. And it certainly has done that with Bill. And I guess I wanted to try and, you know, flesh him out a little bit and kind of capture his complexity, a lot of which has to do with the fact that he's not really as much a stats guy as a great writer and a great thinker. And I'm not sure I accomplished that.
Bill James has been working for the Red Sox for several years now, and various other teams have hired people who embrace the way James evaluates players. To what extent, if any, do you think that's changed the game?
I tend to liken Bill to many different people, but one of them, Charles Darwin. Obviously, he's not, you know, as big an influence on the world as Charles Darwin, but he's as big an influence on baseball. And one funny thing about Darwin is that even though, obviously, he's incredibly influential on, you know, the way we view nature and the way we see biology, if you poll, you know, the American people, a huge percentage of them, you know, don't accept Darwin's ideas at all. And I think it's similar with Bill, where he's changed things in certain very deep, specific ways. But Bill says, it never surprises me that someone can ignore everything I believe in and still be successful. And I think that a lot of people do ignore Bill and ignore his ideas. But the ones that don't ignore his ideas, I think, have done pretty well so far. You've got the Oakland A's, who certainly are the main sort of symbol of following a lot of Bill's premises. And they've done pretty well. And also the Red Sox.
Bill James does not strike me as the sort of guy who would enjoy having somebody write a book about him. How did he respond to your suggestion that you would like to write a book about him?
At first, Bill demurred and tried to talk me out of it lightly. He certainly felt that he wasn't worthy of such scrutiny. But basically, I think his perspective was that if I wanted to try it, he wasn't going to stop me. He gave me some ground rules, which were that I shouldn't call him on the phone. That was the main one, because he doesn't like to talk on the phone. After the proposal sold, so the book was actually going to become a book, I asked him, you know, what he thought about it and what I should tell my editors. And he said, tell them I was not visibly upset.
As you point out in the book, Bill James is not an easy guy to edit. You maintain that if he spells a player's name wrong in one of his books, he wants it left wrong. If he spells it one way on page 11 and another way on page 13, he wants both versions left in. What was it like working with this guy?
Right. Now, first, I have to say for the record that I didn't actually say that. That was his editor at Ballantyne. So Bill, I didn't say that. But nevertheless, the thing about what I was doing is that Bill didn't look behind it in any way, shape, or form. In fact, you know, he barely looked at it. He sort of just helped me do it. And, you know, he read through parts of it. But, you know, he tends to write these very long, in-depth, and, you know, wonderful, brilliant emails going off on tangents about whatever I would ask him. And, you know, so I tended to take those emails and shape them and kind of move things around. And I just didn't tell him, and hopefully he won't notice.
James is, of course, an entertaining writer. He came up with the nickname Slaughterhouse Luzinski, for goodness sake, which is much better than The Bull, which is what most people call Greg Luzinski. He wrote of Willie Randolph that his skills, quote, preferred the shadows, which is a marvelous phrase. Maybe baseball writers who disparage Bill James' work are just jealous of his talent.
That's a good point. I'm certainly jealous of his talent, and I'm glad you felt that it came out balanced. But, you know, I'm fairly partial to Bill and his writing. And, you know, as I was writing it, it's kind of a big love poem to Bill James. You know, Bill's not really a professional statistician, and he's not really a professional anything except writer. But he's had this huge success. And the reason for that success is that he's so able to bring these things together in one package, both the analytical ability and the ability to express it in really fantastic writing.
Interestingly enough, although many people have accepted James as a real contributor to a way of understanding the game, the Red Sox, for example, employ him, and other teams employ other fellows who have used the same sort of approach as Bill James. Other baseball folks, Joe Morgan, for example, don't feel that way. Joe Morgan is quoted in your book as saying Bill James is a joke. Why is there so much tension on the other side, so much opposition to the kind of thing he's been doing?
I would say, off the top of my head, you know, 99% of Bill's most vocal critics probably haven't read his books. So I think that's the first problem is that, I mean, I don't want to pick on Joe Morgan, as you know, even though it's easy to do. You know, he probably doesn't read Bill's work, and so it's kind of hard to understand the complexity of Bill's ideas and positions if you don't read the work. And so I think that's a big part of it.
Scott, your book makes it clear that Bill James is interested in a great many things besides baseball. The way the justice system works and doesn't work, for example. He's a great reader of crime novels. Do you think he'll ever shift his attention to something other than baseball?
That's a good question. I feel fairly confident in saying that Bill at least has parts of manuscripts, certainly on true crime, which is a huge interest of his. I mean, I would say that in Bill's life, you know, he cares about his family more than anything, and baseball's a close second. But after that, it's politics and true crime and then Diet Pepsi after that, I would say.
Scott Gray is the author of The Mind of Bill James, How a Complete Outsider Changed Baseball, published by Doubleday. He joined me from WBGO in Newark. Scott, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you.
And 6 times 9 is 60 minus 6. You could use those tricks. 'Cause you must have some secret way you can beat it, or else you'll meet it with a naughty number.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Gabrielle Scruggs, Vince Rockchalk, Jayhawk Fairchild, and from David Tallickson at WBGO in Newark. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about the mind of Bill James, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from bracket buff Brian Lackey, who said he'd lose more than just money if Washington were to prevail over Utah State in Thursday's first-round game.
If Utah State doesn't win today, I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. My faith in humanity will be shaken.
You might be the only person that's ever said that.
Not today, I'm not.
I'm Bill Littlefield. I hope your brackets haven't crumbled. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
You can check it, or else you'll wreck it with naughty, nasty, mean old number 9.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows on September 20th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.